Hello, everybody. My name is Nate, and you are listening to All Access Pass Season 5 on CITR 101.9 FM. We are broadcasting live from Vancouver on the unceded territory of the Hukuminam-speaking Musqueam people. In the studio today, I'm joined by all my fellow Accessibility Collective members. Say hi, everybody.
Hi, everyone.
So, today's show topic is going to be quite interesting, as we're going to talk about some of the latest news around Vancouver and in Canada. And we'll also talk about what exactly manors are, manors, M-A-N-O-R-S, and what the connection is between them and people with disabilities. However, before we get into that topic and more, we're going to go to our first song break.
Thanks, Nate. Hello, everyone. Here is the song Perfect by Alanis Morissette from the album Jagged Little Pill.
I went to your house, walked up the stairs, I opened your door without ringing the bell. I walked down the hall into your room where I could smell you, and I shouldn't be without permission, shouldn't be here. Would you forgive me, love, if I dance in your shower? Would you forgive me, love, if I laid in your bed? Would you forgive me, love, if I stay all afternoon? Took off my clothes, put on your robe, went through your drawers and I found your cologne. Went down to the den, found your CDs, and I played your Johnny. And I shouldn't stay long, you might be home soon, I shouldn't stay. Would you forgive me, love, if I dance in your shower? Would you forgive me, love, if I laid in your bed? Would you forgive me, love, if I stay all afternoon? I burn your incense, I ran a bath, I noticed a letter that sat on your desk. It said, hello, love, I love you so, love, meet me at midnight. And no, it wasn't my writing, I better go soon, it wasn't my writing. So forgive me, love, if I cry in your shower. So forgive me, love, for the salt in your bed. So forgive me, love, if I cry all afternoon.
Are you playing her audio? All right. Now, let's get to our current affair news. Allison's going to be talking to us about some interesting topics that have been going around in Vancouver lately. All right, Allison.
Thanks, Nate. So there's some cool events going around. The first event is this upcoming Sunday, where the first person with a disability who was ever elected to be a judge
is coming. Yeah, isn't
that cool? Yeah. Yeah, it's so cool. He's coming to Vancouver. His name is Justice Bernstein, and he is a judge in
Detroit. Yeah.
And he's coming to speak in Richmond, which is cool, at the Chabad of Richmond. The second event that I've heard is a performance, a dance that is, and I'm happening next week, I think Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. And Jesse and I are going to the Wednesday performance. And then the last one is also a dance performance on Sunday, November 24th at the Chutzpah Festival at the Norman Rothstein Theater at 41st and Oak at the JCC, Jewish Community Center. And it is for people who of all abilities, and they will be able to dance, and it's all different types of disabilities and abilities, which is so cool.
Awesome. Thanks, yeah. Allison. So, yeah, all this information will be on our All Access Pass Facebook page, as well as our All Access Pass Twitter page, which is at @access_CITR. So look for the information on there. Okay. Nate, you want to take it away?
All right. So thank you very much for that, Allison. That was super informative. Yeah. And... yeah. And now we're going to go over to Anton, and he has a report on people with Down syndrome having trouble using smart speakers. And with that, how Google is trying to remove social barriers.
Hi, everyone. So in today's day and age, we begin to rely on smart speaker technology more and more. Alexa, Google Home, Siri, etc. And while most people have no problem being recognized by the AI, people with Down syndrome are struggling to be understood. Mm. This was picked up by Google, who partnered with Canadian Down Syndrome Society and was later turned into an entire project called Project Understood. In the beginning, the team began studying speech patterns of people with ALS, but later they realized they could do something better. Google and the CDSS created an online service where people with Down syndrome could donate their voice, which just means recording specific phrases to improve the AI's recognition. This partnership hopes to grant independence to those who need it by making their voices heard and understood 100% instead of the current 70%. Unfortunately, this project is still in its research state, and as Julie Catio, product manager with Google AI, says, we need individuals who feel compelled to record phrases and give them to us.
Yeah. Can I ask a question?
Sure.
So when she says that we need individuals to feel compelled to record phrases, does that mean they're thinking about offering compensation to people who are doing these voice exercises?
I don't believe at the moment. Okay. I think it's more of just like a voluntary thing. But I mean, it helps the cause.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's lots of people who are willing.
Yeah, and Google's pretty strapped for cash.
Yeah.
As we all know.
Well.
Yeah. Maybe they should.
But it's amazing that they're at least trying to make a difference and make it more like accessible as possible. I mean, I use Google. It's not perfect by any means, but at least it does help to help that little bit to, you know, access the community. And also for those who have physical disability to at least communicate on phone. Mm-hmm. So they're trying, but yeah, long ways to go.
Do you use Alexa?
No, I use Google. Okay. Yeah. So it's been very good for me. There is a little bit like it. You really have to be specific when you're asking it to do this and that. And sometimes it doesn't fall at first time, but then the second time it does. Mm-hmm. So there's always pros and cons, but for the most part, it's very helpful. Do you guys have any?
No, I'm afraid of it.
What? You're what?
You know how on Facebook, how if you talk about something and you have your phone, and then suddenly Facebook ads for that thing will appear?
Oh, yeah.
Same.
Well, with Google, actually, it's kind of creepy because sometimes when you're not talking, it's actually talking. And I'm like, what? Like, I didn't even say anything. So now I have to unplug it and then plug it when I need it. Yeah. Sarah, what are you going to say?
I was just going to say my parents recently moved to Edmonton, and I had no friends in Edmonton. So I actually would talk to the Alexa. And I'm not going to say it was one of my proudest moments, but it was a mood for
Did
sure.
Did you bond?
Yeah. So what kind of a conversation, if you don't mind me asking?
Sometimes you just need to talk to someone that's not your parents. You'd be like, hey, Alexa, how's your day going? You know?
Oh, wow.
And Alexa would just be like, it's going okay. Yeah. I'm just sitting here.
She's there for you.
She's there, Aww. Yeah.
That's so sweet.
That's that, yeah.
So, yeah, Nate, you wanted to say something.
Yeah, I think that, like, those Alexas or Google Homes or whatever they are a really good tool, even just for people who, you know, maybe don't necessarily have, like, the... Like, I know for myself, I've had experience with, like, certain family friends.
Yeah.
Who've, you know, used them to, you know, maybe make a better change in their home, because sometimes they don't always have, like, the capacity to be managing, like, mm-hmm. seven things at once. Like, I personally find that, like, it's really hard for me to take the time to get out of a hard working moment and, you know, go onto my calendar somewhere else or my phone or this or that and say, you know, I want to put down this appointment. When is my appointment?
Yeah.
Like, all of these things. If you can just say, like, hey, Google, put down an appointment at 4 p.m. on Thursday for a doctor at 4 or whatever, it does that for you, and then I don't have to, you know, break my focus or lose or even just have to struggle with that, which is something that I've struggled with.
Yeah.
And I just think that that kind of technology is also really cool for that kind of thing. Yeah. So
do you have Google?
I don't have a like the Google Home.
Right.
But my girlfriend's family has Alexa at their house, and it's been working really, really well for their family.
Awesome.
So yeah.
That's great.
Yep. All right. And I think with that, we're gonna hop into our second song break. So here's Jesse.
Welcome back to All Access Pass. The song you heard was Perfect by Alanis Morissette from the album Jagged Little Pill. A little about this artist. She was born in Ottawa. She has struggled with depression and anorexia and bulimia. She's world famous and has won 5 Grammy Awards and Album of the Year. Thank you. Hi again, everyone. The second song I have for you is called The Inescapable Us from Matthew Good, off the album Underdogs.
Looking our way. sparkling spot hasn't dried. That's fate stealing away. Sparkling spot hasn't caught, hasn't caught, hasn't caught, hasn't caught.
Welcome back to All Access Pass. The song you heard was, before the break, was Inescapable Us from Matthew Good from the album Underdogs. A bit about Matthew. He was born in Burnaby. He's a singer and a songwriter, and he has struggled with bipolar dysphoric mania. The Matthew Good Band was one of the most successful bands in Canada, and Matthew has also had a successful solo musician career.
All right. Thank you, Jesse. It's always refreshing to get double the song explanations. I really feel informed, so thanks for that. Now, let's get back to our current affair news. Here's Brett, who unfortunately couldn't be with us in the studio today, but she gave us an excellent pre-recording on how Ticketmaster is making some improvements when it comes to accessibility. All right.
Revamping their policies for disabled folks. The BBC recently wrote an article about how Ticketmaster is revamping their policies for disabled folks buying tickets. Disabled folks want to go to concerts. That should be clear. There are people who are hearing impaired, people who have wheelchairs that they need to get in and out of a venue, and others need to have someone come along with them. Who can afford that extra ticket? Ticketmaster has had accommodations for disabled folks for a while now, like they should. But disabled customers have had to use a phone to call a hotline and talk to them, which, if you're deaf, is a major inconvenience. Then, every time you want to go to a concert, you have to prove on the phone that you have a disability. It's a terrible system. Ticketmaster is finally moving towards an online system. You can upload information proving you're disabled, and it will be on your Ticketmaster profile forever, so once it's proven for good. You don't have to ever do that again. You don't have to call anyone, and it's going to make everything easier. Ticketmaster still has to get the venues to agree and implement this policy, but in the UK, some huge arenas have already agreed. Considering that disabled fans make up 11% of the live music audience, this is a huge opportunity for making money. If only they'd done this earlier, they probably could have made significantly more money. Either way, this is a great step forward.
Wow. Thank you, Brett. That's honestly just really cool, even based on the idea of making it simpler for just about anybody to consistently, you know, use your platform and make it easier, especially when it's already harder for them to enjoy the things they love. So,
yeah.
Cheers.
And I want to add, too, is like when you call constantly and then explaining what your disability is, now you don't have to worry about that because it's all in the file, right?
Exactly. And then it's kind of a one and done thing, right? Instead of this like, oh, I want to go to this concert. Oh, now I have to explain my disability again.
And for those of you who don't know, but it is actually exhausting to explain, having to explain each person what your disability is and how it really works when you don't really know, per se, how to explain someone. So this is great move by Ticketmaster. So good for them.
Do you find you have to provide like evidence in order to receive accommodations, or will they take your word for it?
In the past, like I've only been once, and they had to take my word for it.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, and then I think when the actual event comes in, then I show an ID or some sort of, yeah. Nate, have you used it?
I personally have not, per se. Okay. I think part of it is just when I have a visual disability.
Yeah.
And when I go to an event, I kind of have to make sure, like on my own end, that I get a seat that's close enough to the stage so that I'm not, you know, unable to see what's going on. It's never a fun time when that happens. So that's usually just a my end thing. Like it's not, I didn't even actually know that you could request accommodation. So that's actually pretty cool.
Yeah.
And I'm really hoping that what Ticketmaster is doing here just becomes the norm, both for them and with any venue and any company that does that kind of thing.
Yeah, for me, like I have, because I use a wheelchair, I have to explain that I need an accessible space because for the chair and all that kind of stuff. And I have an attendant with me, so I have to explain all this to them. But now things will get easier and it'll be on their file, so you don't have to worry about that after, which is awesome.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
All right, and I think with that, we're going to pass it over to Allison again, who's going to talk us about a story going viral on how an autism diagnosis sparked a fire captain's desire to create special autism kits for children.
Thanks, Nate. So recently, a firefighter, the Clearview fire captain, Mark Den Bock, created special kits for children in times of emergencies and stress. Den Bock was inspired by a family member who was diagnosed on the autism spectrum. They're called comfort kits, and in it, it has a blanket, a stuffy, safety glasses, headphones, and a fidget spinner. Even though this was originally for children on the autism spectrum, all children can benefit from these kits. I have also heard of calm down kits for adults in times of high stress. These can include many different things, but are directed by the person and can encompass all five senses. I think it is helpful for all people, especially for those in high stress times and emergencies, like going to the hospital or in a fire. Now here's Jesse and another song.
Thanks so much. The third song I have for you is called Parliament Got Bombed by Mike Nagoda. Welcome back to All Echo.
Hold the presses, have you heard the news? Coming on down from the hill now. 6 p.m. and a tragedy struck, and nobody knows what to do now. A distinguished member from the Southern Riding, well, a bomber plays to hail, confused and distraught in the middle. He pushed the button, hopeless fail, hopeless fail. Parliament got bombed tonight, and now the nation's alive. People run and fry. Yeah, Parliament's been bombed tonight. in the present. I pray us no more words to say. Life's a dogma, it's led to moral decay. But at least we are still got faith. And as the ashes get hit by the moonlight, the crowd does gather and declare. Now a nation's alight. The people stand to fight. This parliament's been bound tonight.
Welcome back to All Access Pass. The song you just heard was Parliament Got Bombed by Mike Nagoda. A little bit about Mike. He is from Toronto and is a blues musician. He was born with cerebral palsy and likes to play the guitar and piano. He is also openly gay and polyamorous.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Jesse, for that song and that little bit of information on the artist. Now we're going to get back to our current affair news, and Lydia is going to talk to us about a talk called Relocating Disability.
Thanks, Nate. So today we're going to be playing a portion of an interview with Norman Kunk and Emma Vanderclift, and this is Norman speaking about critical disability theory, and at the very beginning here he's going to be describing it as amorphous.
It's very amorphous, theoretical idea. So I think the easiest way to help people get into this area is this story.
Okay.
And I want to tell you about sort of the point in my life where it was a pivotal moment that led me to see disability in a new way. And so to begin with, I was obviously born with cerebral palsy, and I went to the segregated school for disabled kids in Toronto. Uh-huh. And a prominent part of that was physical therapy, 3 times a week. And I like to say I was the kid that physical therapists only see in their dreams. Right? They wanted me to do 10 repetitions of a certain exercise. I did 20. They want me to hold a precarious balance position for 30 seconds. I held it for a minute. Because I was determined that I was going to live a meaningful, happy, fulfilled life. And at that time, I saw the biggest impediment to that was my disability. So it was so that I declared war on my disability. That was the enemy. And for those years, I really got focused on getting into regular school. That was sort of winning the war. If I could get into regular school, and eventually I did that in grade 8. I argued myself into regular school, but what surprised me was the war didn't end. I just changed battlefields. Because now, rather than becoming as non-disabled as I could in the therapy room, I had to become as non-disabled as I could be in the lunchroom, in the hallways. So, third year in university, I'm in a pub with a bunch of my friends. And one of my friends tells a story which involves me. And when he gets to my part of the story, he imitates the way I talk. And he says, and then Norman walks up and says, oh, whoa, look at my lunch. Oh, Fred, so afterwards I go, Fred, why do you imitate my voice? And because you talk like that. And you go, yeah, Fred, but look, I'm picking up the glass in one hand, I'm articulating my words clearly. I've gotten a cameo performance here. You imitate my voice, my whole show goes out the window. And Fred looked at me and said, Norman, why are you trying to be non-handicapped? And as strange as it sounds, that was the first time that question was ever put to me. We drank a lot of beer that night.
Yeah.
And around the second jug of draft, I remember saying the phrase, the right to be disabled. Mm-hmm. I sort of sat back and listened to my own words and went, whoa. I think at that moment, I could see my life changed. Because prior to that night, I'd seen disability solely as something within my body. It was an abnormality deficiency. But that night, what I suddenly realized was I had a people. They saw disability rather than in a physiological context, in social context, and in a couple ways. First of all, they recognized that in every culture in the world, there are people with physical and or mental disabilities. So, you know, I was part of that group of people, but even struck me further that throughout time, you know, in every civilization, in every age, that there have been disabled people. The Bible, the Roman, the Ming Dynasty, the Mayan culture, there have always been disabled people. Now we usually got killed, but we were there. And what I realized at that moment was that I was part of the normal diversity of the human community.
So, you know, I'm excited about the, like, what I'm seeing is the interconnections of these different kinds of struggles and making more room for others. And one thing you were kind of giving me a heads up about was this idea about relocating the problem of disability, you know, from the medical realm into the social. Can I say something about that?
Can I say something to Rick? Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
I think it really goes back to what Michael White said about the person is not the problem, the problem is the problem.
One of our mentors is a guy called John McBride, who worked a lot in the civil rights movement in the 50s and 60s, trying to get the auto industry integrated. And he's a great quote. He says, revolutions begin when people who are defined as problem achieve the power to redefine the problem. And the example he used is the civil rights movement really began to get momentum when they were able to redefine the problem from a black problem to a white problem.
Yeah.
Right? It's not a problem of black skin. It's a problem of white prejudice, white privilege.
And white supremacy.
So that was a really key line for me. So if you think of the predominant narrative in our society, the pervasive narrative, the pervasive story in which we all get immersed in, is this idea that people shouldn't be disabled. Mm-hmm. Now, for example, me. You, knowing me, you may be fully committed to inclusive education, disability rights, etc., right? But on another level, on a deeper level, you may work from the presumption that Norm is not the way he should have been.
Yeah.
Norman should have been born non-disabled. Something happened at birth. So now Norman is not the way he should have been. No.
Yeah.
If you work from that presumption,
yeah,
you're locating the problem in me.
Yeah.
All right. So, for example, the way this is explained, if I come up these set of stairs and you see that set of stairs and my inability to go over those stairs as a mobility impairment. Mm-hmm. Now you can be, you know, fully in favor of ramps, etc., but the belief is in installing that ramp is to accommodate the problem in me.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
To relocate the problem means we go from the presumption that people should not be disabled into the idea that disability is an inherent part of the human experience. Mm-hmm. Bodies break down, accidents happen, this idea that we should be non-disabled throughout our lives is delusional. Mm-hmm. Once we see disability as an inherent part of the human experience, then when you see me wheeling up the set of stairs, my inability to get up the stairs isn't a result of the mobility impairment in me, it's that this building was built on the premise of that no one should be disabled. Mm-hmm. So.
And that was Norman Kunk and Emma Vandercliff. Norman has cerebral palsy and Emma has autism. They make a career out of speaking at conferences all over the world, and in July they presented at UBC. Back to you, Nate. And Allison was there.
She was. Thank you, Lydia. Now, here's Sarah with our second show topic for today, which is manners built specifically for people with disabilities in the United States in the 70s and 80s. Sarah, what exactly is this all about? Wait, better yet, what are Kirkbride manners?
Oh. Do, do, do,
do. Whoa, hey, it's me. Thanks, Nate. Do you ever wonder where those spooky haunted houses get their design from? It's none other than the Kirkbride Manors. These were initially built as the perfect sanctuaries for the mentally ill. These manors were beautifully built estates on large acreages that poised promise and community as a treatment for those that had mental health issues. Although very popular initially, these mansions eventually lost popularity and financial support, and became the desolate and rundown manors that we expect now in these spooky, creepy movies. Dr. Kirkbride was a physician, and he was born in 1809 in rural Pennsylvania. He originally wanted to be a surgeon. However, at age 31, he was given the opportunity to become a superintendent in a new hospital in Pennsylvania, the Pennsylvania Hospital for the Insane. His previous training and experience interning at asylums, as well as his ambition, intellect, and strong sense of purpose, enabled him to become a massive authority of mental health at the time. On December 16, 1883, Dr. Kirkbride died of pneumonia at the age of 74. It was at his home on the grounds of the Pennsylvania Hospital for the Insane. Kirkbride was a founding member for the Association of Medical Superintendents of the American Institutions for the Insane. Through this association and his writings, Kirkbride promoted a standard method of asylum construction and mental health treatment, popularly known as the Kirkbride Plan, which significantly influenced the entire American asylum community during his lifetime. So Dr. Kirkbride wrote about his ideals in a book on the construction, organization, and general arrangements of hospitals for the insane, where he wrote about the Kirkbride Plan. This was a system of mental health designs based on the concept of moral treatment, environmental determinism. And the first hospital was Trenton State Hospital in Trenton, New Jersey, constructed in 1848. And considered such a good idea that it moved throughout the United States rapidly. These hospitals were built in many different ways. However, they were always contingent on the concepts of environment, exposure to natural light, and air circulation. And Dr. Kirkbride believed this was beneficial to the mental health of patients. The Kirkbride Mansions also had the famous and common batwing-style floor plan, housing numerous wings that sprawl outward from the center. These Kirkbride asylums were large, imposing buildings with linear building footprint and many corridors extending staggered wings from the center, resembling a bat's wingspan. There were usually about 8 wings, accommodating 250 patients, which was huge. The furthest wings from the center of the buildings were reserved for the most excitable or most physically dangerous and volatile patients. The concept was, as they made progress, these patients would be moved further towards the center, closer to the center and eventual exit of the asylum, and they would feel like they were making progress. Patient rooms were spacious and tall, but only large enough to room a single person. The center complexes of the Kirkbride Plan buildings were designed to house administration, kitchens, public and reception areas, and apartments for the superintendent's family. Kirkbride's philosophy behind the staggered wings was to allow individual corridors open to the sunlight and ventilation through both ends, which he believed aided in the healing of the mentally ill. Each wing also had a parlor, bathroom, clothes room, and infirmary, and even a speaking tube for open communication throughout the building. Kirkbride thought so thoroughly of the design, he even intentionally designed the toothbrush holders. Kirkbride also advocated for fertile and spacious landscape, which the hospitals were built on, with a minimum of 100 acres in size. The foliage on the grounds were maintained for physical exercise and therapy by patients. These eventually evolved into sprawling, expansive grounds with numerous buildings. Throughout the remainder of the 19th century, numerous psychiatric hospitals were designed under the Kirkbride Plan across the United States. By the 20th century, the popularity of the design had waned, largely due to economic pressures of maintaining the immense facilities, as well as contestation of Dr. Kirkbride's theories amongst the medical community. Dr. Kirkbride had many guidelines, including building operations and staffing. This included how many physicians should be nearby, where staff would live, and the balanced distribution of female and male members being about equal. Kirkbride believed that about 71 staff should be in a hospital of 250 patients, including supervisors, teachers, chaplains, matrons, physicians, nurses, and night watchmen, with everyone carefully selected to create a relaxing environment. He also believed that able-minded patients could help maintain the hospital grounds and assist in duties in their respective wards, benefiting both them and the hospital. The establishment of state mental hospitals in the U.S. occurred after Dorothea Dix, who testified in the New Jersey legislature in 1844, vividly described the state's treatment of lunatics. They were being housed in county jails, private homes, and the basements of public buildings. Dix's effort led to the construction of the New Jersey State Lunatic Asylum, the first complete asylum built on the Kirkbride Plan. So yeah, that's how people were thought of as more than just insane.
That's really cool. Thank you, Sarah. I think that's just really awesome because it's been a theme as time goes on, kind of like the humanizing of humanity. And I think just to kind of hear how those kinds of stories aren't all just like you know, right now in the like in the recent time, and there have like always been people who have been such forward-thinking people with care for people who need it, and people who, well, really everybody, because everybody deserves to be accepted and to be welcome and to have a space that works for them. And I think that's kind of what accessibility is all about, right? It's just making sure that no matter who you are, no matter where you are, no matter what your situation is in life, you have a place that makes you feel welcome, that makes you feel better, that makes you just feel happy, right?
Yeah, that's so true. And nobody should be excluded, but included. If we all work together, then yeah, we can be more inclusive, right? So what do you have anything to say, Lydia?
I just think that was a super cool look into how certain societies and certain people in those societies like change what is around them and relate to like wellness.
Yeah.
Awesome
work.
All right, and I think with that we're going to close off our show.
Yeah.
But just before we do that, I want to give a quick shout out to my mom, whose birthday is today. So happy birthday, Mom.
Happy birthday, Nate's mom.
Love you, Mom. You're the best. Thanks
and
for being there for me.
I just want to say my aunt's in studio.
Yeah.
She's checking the live show, so it's great to have her here. And, thank you for being here.
Yes, thank you.
Absolutely. All right.
And then last week we had Allison's grandpa came. Yeah. We didn't have a live show, unfortunately, but he was able to come by to the studio and check CITR out. And so that was really neat. Allison, do you want to talk about that?
Hi, Grandpa.
Hi.
Yeah, just send us your family members. Just
Absolutely.
Yeah. So. And on that note, I guess that wraps up our show. And
Absolutely.
A big shout out to Nicole Lee, who unfortunately isn't here, but she's listening. So hope you're doing well, and we'll catch you next time on Nicole. So we're thinking of you. And so if you are interested in joining our team or think that there's an issue we should bring up on our show, please send us an email at accessibilitycollective@citr.ca.
All right, and be sure to like our All Access Pass Facebook page.
If you're on Twitter or Instagram or both, please follow us at access.citr.
And if you missed part of our live show today or want to listen again to today's show, you can do so on citr.ca. Just search up All Access Pass.
Thank you for listening, and tune in to our show in 2 weeks, Wednesday, November 27th at 3 p.m. Hi, Grandpa, again.
Hi.
All right. Oh, and please stick around for C-Pop Connections with Sabrina Hsieh coming up next. And before we leave, here's another song for you. Here's Eliza Hall with Echoes. Enjoy the song, and thank you so, so much, everybody. Goodbye, and have a great couple of weeks.
Bye. Bye.
Close up.
You give me that single mother strength. SRTY to the bank. I just work like 90 hours. I don't need to smile, thanks. Oh my yeah, yesterday y'all malakas who mess up your chakra, so we all we need. And if a man wanna come at me crazy, my mama gave me all the tools to lead. It's more than a fantasy, way past the dress in the fanny. It's bigger than fairy tales, word to my granny. That's word to the girls who come after me, word to the girls in the factory. Word to Catherine Johnson, word to my mama. I will not fail, that's word to your honor. Promise my sisters, I will not miss this. That's word after word after word with no comma. Like
champion sound from the few of us. Man down, that's word to my uterus. Yes, I manicure my cuticles while I handle not unusual. All the bags I'm bringing through the west. Strength is something that they don't associate with women. That empowerment and winning.